Welcome to the first post-Christmas Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. We are open for business once again. My name is Mike Quackenbush. Clayton Morris joins me each and every week here on the mothership of Grizzly Productions. The kids are calling it Da Grizz.
The Grizz, you know, because they're so down with it. They may have found us on iTunes recently in a featured section with our feature with Toad the Wet Sprocket. So maybe that's why they're thinking, yeah, this is what the cool kids are listening to these days.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe this is what they were listening to in the 90s. I don't know.
That's right.
Hey, anyway, how was your Christmas?
Well,
did Santa bring you everything your little heart desired?
Wow, I did. What a strange assortment, a crazy menagerie of things I got. Thank you very much, by the way, for everything that you sent my way on behalf of your family, for my family, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, this every year it's a little bit different for you and I. We don't always see one another at this time of year. And Clayton's birthday is upcoming in just a few days. It's only about a week between Christmas and his birthday. So I never really know. Sometimes I get to see you, sometimes I don't. So I kind of go through this every year where I have stuff that I hold on to thinking I'm going to see you, but I don't know that I will. And maybe what I really need to do is just mail it to you.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably the best thing because I don't know when I'll get to see you next. God knows with the holiday travel season and the moving and shaking with family members coming in and everything else, plus all the big storms. Who knows when I'll...
There's a big storm coming, is there?
Yeah, there's two big storms, actually. So through the Midwest, there was that big storm that hit Indiana, and that's heading east. In fact, it may hit tonight. Mm. So I'm supposed to work tomorrow, so I'm like, should I go sleep in the city tonight? You know, like get a hotel room? Because I don't know if I'll be able to get to work early in the morning with a big storm coming through. So it could be a little crazy. But yeah, I would say probably just mailing would be the best.
Right, and I know this is a little weird, but I have a pen handy. Tell me your address.
Not weird at all. It's the YMCA.
Uh-huh.
I'm usually there in the after. That's where I keep my P.O. box.
Hmm. Is that where all the free CDs you get from BMG go?
Right. Have you seen some of the video clips lately of like UPS guys swiping packages off of people's front porches?
I saw like a screen capture or a freeze frame of, you know, something that was tagged like, don't make this UPS man mad. And it was clear he was like either stomping a package or something. So I'm aware that's been out there, but I haven't watched any of it.
Yeah. People who have like webcams and different things like security cams on the front of their door. And we actually have one too at our house.
Right.
And so, you know, we'd be able to see anybody that did something like that. But, yeah, they have, like, you can see, like, the camera, like, where the UPS guy brings up to the front door, and he signs for it, and he puts it down, and he realizes it's an iPad mini, and then he takes the iPad mini for himself. And then, of course, there's the camera, and the owner's called the police, and, of course, UPS apologized, fired the guy. He was arrested, and then they also refunded him, you know, the iPad mini cost. So that's just the kind of PR that UPS needs right now at the holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Trust that your packages arrive and one of our guys will swipe it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think at this time of year, all those types of services, they end up taking on additional help that maybe they, you know, they can't do as thorough a job of screening as they might do other times of the year because they're just so swamped. In fact, there was a package that I was really kind of counting on getting before Christmas that only just showed up today, the 26th. So even with all the additional help, UPS and FedEx and the post office, they still couldn't get all the packages delivered in time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had just ordered some things, too, that just arrived today instead of, ahead of time. And that's actually partially due to the weather. FedEx put up on their website saying, you know, like big winter storm affecting shipping routes through Wisconsin, Michigan. There was a bunch of big winter storms that moved through. So anyway. So, hey, I got you a CD. And I'm curious, you never responded to my text about it, but if you had ever heard it, knew anything about it, because I sure as heck didn't until
I was doing
some digging.
That's right. I forgot that you did text me that. Well, I'll tell you. I'll answer you right now here in a public forum. I did. I want to say 1992 or at the latest, I guess early 93, Michael Nesmith appeared on Austin City Limits, that long-running public broadcast show that like everybody ever has appeared on at least once.
Right.
And this is how I know that it existed. It aired during around this time of year. It must have been end of 92, I'm thinking. Because we were definitely on Christmas break.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I had gone somewhere. I kind of think we went to the comfy chair. And we came back home, and my brother, who my brother's name is Andy, and he's 3 years younger than I am. He and I had a few musical tastes in common, but for the most part, we did not. He and I both were kind of into the Monkees as a result of their reunion in the 80s. In fact, I think he had the cassette of Pool It before I did. And we liked NXS, but other than that, you know, he kind of liked some stuff that was no good, like Vanilla Ice, and I liked stuff that was super awesome, like They Might Be Giants. However, on this night, you and I, we came home from wherever we had gone over the holidays, and my brother had recorded for me on a VHS cassette tape Austin City Limits, because he either was flipping channels and saw it, or saw it in the TV guide or whatever, that Michael Nesmith was the guest. So he was able to capture, like, the last three songs of his set. And it is kind of notable in that I think that's the only recording of him ever playing Twilight on the Trail live. The others are kind of like they've become staples of his live show. Of course, Joanne is his most famous single, Rio, Laugh Kills Lonesome, etc.
Right.
Was okay, that... I'm glad you're with me.
Oh, I didn't know if that was the end of a thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so...
I'd seen that on VHS before, but it was great to have that audio format.
I don't think I ever saw the VHS of that.
It's right around the same time as Live at the Brit was recorded, you know?
Yeah.
So it's with the exception of the percussionist, I think, had changed. I think instead of Luis Conte, he had Scott Shepard with him. Other than that, it's the same lineup. You know, John Jorgensen's with him, John Hobbs, Joe Chimay on bass. It's the same guys playing around him. He even, like, uses some of the same banter between songs that he uses on Live at the Brit.
Right, yeah.
And one of the things that I really kind of, I don't know, I find it very endearing about Papa Nez is, did you listen to it? Did you listen to those recordings, by the way, those MP3s?
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
I'm sure you caught this too. At least once or twice, he flubs the lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I find very endearing. Like, these are his songs. Like,
right.
He wrote these songs, and he gets the lyrics wrong, which I kind of love.
I think he does that on Laugh Kills Lonesome, right?
Right. Like, he'll keep singing when he shouldn't, you know, like it's like time for the mandolin solo, and he just keeps talking, you know, or whatever. And it's more clear on the VHS. He completely flubs one of the lines in Rio. And, like, he's even laughing at himself. You know, he's, like, in front of this huge audience and live on national public television. And he just kind of, like, laughs at himself because he doesn't even remember the lyric correctly. So, I kind of love that. There's something very endearing about that to me.
Yeah, it was remarkable because I had gone to that Austin City Limits store, remember, mm-hmm. At the airport.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In Austin, Texas last year during South by Southwest. And I think I picked up for your birthday the David Byrne Austin mm-hmm. City Limits, which I never knew he did an Austin City Limits performance either.
Yeah, he's done more than one David Byrne.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware of that. And so anyway, I didn't see, you know, there was no Mike Nesmith stuff there at all. And I was looking for Sting, Nesmith. I didn't see anything. So this rare recording that your brother made of the VHS is probably all that exists out there in the ether.
Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Austin City Limits one of those shows where you can write to them, and if you include the cost of the tape, because it's public TV, they will make you a copy and send it to you for free?
I think you're right. Yeah, I remember seeing at the end of every episode, they would have like a, you know, an 800 number plus a mailing address. You just mail a check. It would be like $29.99 or something like that.
Yeah,
where they would do that. I don't know if – does public TV still do that? I don't know that they still do that.
I have no idea.
It seems like the overhead to have somebody there with a VCR making a recording is probably more than they can afford at this time. But
And who knows where that VHS is now. You know, there are some rarities like that, you know, that kind of only exist that way, like that spinoff from Elephant Parts that he did that contained some of the funnier bits from Television Parts that was called Dr. Duck's Secret All-Purpose Sauce or whatever that was. Only existed like on VHS. And do you remember Jared Jarsacrack had a laser disc of it?
Yes.
I always thought that was such a strange thing. This friend of ours who was really into, like, death metal happened to have this weird...
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Laserdisc and picture disc are the same thing, right?
Ooh. I don't know the answer to that.
Wow, I thought for sure you would have an answer for that because you at least had one of the two.
Yeah, I certainly had Laserdisc. I don't know what picture disc is. I think that might be something different. Unless that
when did Laserdisc roll out? Like when did that first hit the market?
I think that was in the late 80s, early 90s. I think just like the compression. I mean, of course, they were the size of a record.
Yeah,
they were not small like a DVD. Mm-hmm. Even those early DVDs were not, they're not well made. So when we made the jump to DVDs, I had some of those early DVDs, like As Good As It Gets, The Player, and some of those films, and like The Abyss and stuff. They're not good presses of the movies. The Laserdiscs, and sometimes if you got like the Criterion edition of a Laserdisc, like the one side of the disc would be super like uncompressed, so you could watch like shot by shot of Harrison Ford jumping off of the moving train in The Fugitive, and then the other sides of the discs would be more compressed, I guess is the deal. So you'd have like many discs, and you'd have to stop them. Or if you had like me, the Laserdisc player that did the switcheroo, when it was done with one side, the laser head would move around like on a crane to the other side and continue playing. But you always had to stop it,
Yeah.
So if you had to make
Remember that. I remember watching Glengarry Glen Ross that way with you.
Yeah.
And maybe there is an alternate machine, because I would say in the mid-80s, whenever something like that picture disc, laser disc player hit the market, the computer teacher I had when I was still going to a Catholic grade school, the computer teacher came in with this new piece of technology that she wanted to show us. And as part of like the bundle, like you know how when you bought your 8-bit NES system, Super Mario Brothers came bundled in with it. This came bundled with elephant parts. And because that just happened to be the disc that came with it, she put that in and started showing it to the class. And that was the first that I became aware that, like, that's really when I knew that the monkeys were not – how do I want to put this? To me, like, the monkeys and 60s Batman, the way – when I saw them on television, I thought that show was current. As a kid, I did not understand that show was from 20 years ago. But the minute I saw Michael Nesmith in elephant parts in my computer class in grade school, I realized, like, he's a lot older than I thought he was. I had no clue that those shows were ancient.
It's interesting. I think I had an awareness of that. I think I was very aware, like, that Star Trek was from, many years before my time. I think I always had that, maybe because I was a lover of history or something, I had an awareness of sort of my spatial history as it related to the things I was into. Mm-hmm. So I understood, because I was such a monkey – I'm sorry. I was such a Beatles fan at such a young age and a Monkees fan, that I was just aware that it was from a bygone era. Mm-hmm. And I think because of my love of television, and I work in television, I had an awareness that things just look different. Mm-hmm.
Sure, the cars and that kind of thing. I think there are little cues there, but – especially Batman and the Monkees, they both came on the air in 1966. They ran for roughly the same amount of time. One ran for two seasons, the other ran for two and a half. That's like such a perfect slice of that era of U.S. television history. And
right.
It seemed very consistent to me. It's not like when you watch that, for example, something I definitely understood to be old was My Favorite Martian. When that would come on, It's black and white. It's clearly much, much older than everything else in the block of reruns on Fox 29 in the afternoons.
Right. Yeah, there were a couple of shows like that. In fact, it seemed like it was just like the golden era of television, really, when you look at like the 60s run of science fiction and the stuff that we were into. Because I've only recently, thanks to Hulu Plus, I think last year or maybe 2 years ago, I discovered, because, Hulu was able to license, for those of you who aren't familiar with that, by the way, some of the major networks came together. They don't all individually own it, but, News Corp or the Fox Broadcasting Network, ABC and NBC, among others, of course, and Film Archives and so forth. In fact, you have, I think, every Criterion movie ever made is on Hulu. which is pretty cool. All the extras and bonus stuff that you get with a Criterion movie. So these major networks sort of came together, but it was built by sort of a third party. So they're sort of managed independently, I think, of the networks, even though they all have an ownership in it. And I think CBS is joining Hulu in just after the new year. So in January, I think CBS joins, which is great because if you're a Star Trek fan, or if you like any of the old CBS-owned properties.
I thought you were about to say, if you like unfunny sitcoms.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure all the new versions of all their latest sitcoms will be on there also. But I'm talking about the classic stuff, the CBS-owned stuff. I mean, let's run down some of the names that you know spring to mind, right? I mean, you've got like, what, Dallas? Was like, I mean, if you were into Dallas, you know, you might have interest in that, watching those old
Falcon's Crest.
Yeah, Falcon's Crest. But what about some of the other properties like I'm trying to remember, but like A-Team or some of the stuff that we liked, were they CBS properties? Because I feel like there's got to be a treasure.
A-Team was on NBC.
What else was CBS though? Was there any what about Batman? Was Batman?
No, that was ABC. ABC had both the Monkees and Batman.
Because I feel like soon we're going to see some of these rights opened up that will enable us to watch some of this stuff. But anyway,
well, you know that's been resolved, the licensing with the 60s Batman right.
Right, yeah. We talked about it here on the show.
Yeah.
When the news first broke. I don't know if there's been any further movement towards a DVD collection of that yet.
All the stuff starts rolling out next year. Oh. They are doing a full action figure line based on the look of the characters from the 60s Batman series. That's the first property that's been licensed out of that since they resolved the licensing issue. And all the news places that carried it said, like, they're all but certain that the next thing they're going to announce is the official DVD release.
Sweet.
Of Batman from the 1960s. But yeah, the fact that they're doing an action figure line based on all those, I was like, oh, this is tremendous.
Yeah,
tremendous.
That's great. I guess my point was that there's all these classic shows I discovered thanks to jumping on Hulu at one point, because like shows like Land of the Giants.
Wow, that's an old one.
Yeah, or even just like Lost in Space, I hadn't watched, but like Land of the Giants, where I guess they like get caught in some, there's like a space exploration, or they're up in the upper atmosphere, they get caught in some sort of lightning storm and they crash land on Earth, and when they get out they realize like they are, you know, 50 times as large as the other humans nearby. And I think it only lasted like one season, Land of the Giants. But then you had other shows from that time that I've become a fan of thanks to Hulu. It's Time Tunnel.
Oh, yeah. You know, that's one of those shows that gets referenced by all kinds of sci-fi creators.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's from that same group, right? It was from 1966 to 1967. What a great time that would have been to be like watching television, because you had all these sci-fi experiments at the time. So it was created by Irwin Allen, you remember, who did Lost in Space.
Right.
So it was on the heels of his success of Lost in Space. But the premise is that it's time travel, and I love anything time travel, if it's well done, or even moderately well done, like Time Tunnel. And this was his like third science fiction show that Irwin Allen did. I think – I can't remember the first one. I know that it's his third one though. And it was on ABC also. And the U.S. government builds this experimental time machine. And it starts, you know, you have to watch the first episode to see these two scientists that get inadvertently sort of thrown back into time in this project called TikTok. And it was like located underground, hidden in like the desert, this complex was. And every episode, you know, they try to get back to present day. And the Time Tunnel scientists are able to watch them on like a giant plasma screen, like in the facility. And they're like, where are they? They're like, I think they're in in the War of 1812. You know, and they're like caught in – and I love it because they're like – they get caught in like specific historical moments, like right before all hell breaks loose. So there's this like big big comet shower that's coming down. And they like – it's going to – it ends up like blowing up a whole town. They like arrive there. This pivotal war in the War of 1812, right before the Battle of New Orleans, they land and wind up in there. So and at the end of every episode, they get sucked into a new time and you never know where they are, and they kind of arrive there and they have to try to figure out where they are, which is kind of cool. I mean, it's, you know, it's a cool premise. So two seasons, but that's like one of those shows that was from that golden era, 66, right in the Star Trek 66 to 69 was Star Trek, I think.
Right. Yeah, I don't know how we ended up down that tangent, but we did. Talking about laser discs and picture discs. Hey, I'm going to tell you this. This is because now, the season's really over. If you've been with us for a number of seasons here on The Grizz, and we are here, this is 4+ years we've been running this, you'll recall that in the early days of The Grizz, I often spoke of the McDonald's holiday pie. And there was a period of time where Clayton even refuted its existence. You used to like to purport the idea that there was no such thing. Of course there is.
I've still never seen one.
It's the you've never seen one in the wild. it's like you see them right out that lake out back of your place there.
Like walking through the woods.
The Tink Wig. Mm-hmm. There it is. A little family of them. they are delicious. They are the greatest of the fast food desserts is the McDonald's holiday pie, and it only exists for a very limited period of time. So during this period of time, throughout the whole rest of the year, I might eat one, McDonald's pie. You can get the apple pie pretty much all year round, and then they have a couple, seasonal ones that come and go. They have a pumpkin one, they have a sweet potato one, the cherry one is a typical variant. But you got about a month to enjoy the holiday pie, and then it's gone. And I have had an unbelievably bad time trying to get a holiday pie. And I think I told some of this to you when we had lunch a little while ago.
Right. One of them was they'd given it to you and it wound up still frozen?
Yes. So I got one to start the season, and it was great, as I knew it would be.
Which one was it?
The holiday pie. Then the next time I ordered a holiday pie, a couple days later, I'm like, I want another holiday pie. So I stopped in at a McDonald's, and this was the dynamic going on. There was a manager there, an older woman, I would say, in her 60s, managing the place, who spoke English. And all of her employees spoke Spanish. And it was like one of those things where, she's kind of making the effort, but it's borderline insulting, por favor, un holiday payo, And then the guys in the back scramble around to get something. And I thought, oh, wow, this is probably not going to end up right. And I was right. I'm already gone. I'm driving away. And I pull it out. And they put the pie still frozen into the box. It never made it into the oven. And you can't eat it that way.
I mean, my point to you was, unless you had – what would be perfect would be if you had – one of the
the Easy Bake ovens.
Yeah, if you had one of the Easy Bake ovens, right? Because then you could just put that thing in, let it sit. Because the Easy Bake ovens, they took 12 hours to cook something.
That's right. Yeah, I'd still be waiting for it.
You'd be warmed by that little light bulb. You'd have a perfect holiday pie whenever you wanted it.
Yeah, my electric bill would be $200, and I still wouldn't have the pie. So I thought, okay, well, this happens from time to time, right?
And you should know, you work there. how many people with disappointed orders after they drove through your window?
Right, yeah, absolutely. Especially when they ordered, what was that one, the one that it was renowned for how horrible it tasted? Was it the McLean Deluxe? Do you remember this?
Yeah.
People would just come back with the box and be like, this tastes like cardboard. Everyone would say that. And eventually they got rid of it.
Yeah, they're like, well, that's actually how it's supposed to taste.
Right. The McLean Deluxe. So next one I order, a couple more days go by. I'm like, I got to try again. And McDonald's has changed their pricing, by the way, on the pies. I don't know if you remember this, but for a while, it was one for 99 cents or two for a dollar. So that of course you would get the second pie. The thing is, these pies are not really healthy for you. So you've got to try, Then when McDonald's started to become a little more health conscious, they've restructured it. Now, most McDonald's, you can get a pie for 59 cents, which is great.
Yeah.
So, it's not the end of the world. To be out 59 cents is not the end of the world to me. And I'm definitely not driving back. If I'm already in my car and I've left, I'm not going back to the McDonald's to have, the horrible discussion with them about, we thought you wanted it frozen. So next one I get, it's been in the thing too long, and it's stone cold. It's absolutely cold. Now, it had been baked, but I knew from the timestamp, which you and I know how to read from our days as Mick employees, this thing had been left in the pie warmer too long, and it was no longer warm. So I thought, man, what are the odds of this, right? Two in a row, I got no good. Here's the next one. I said, at the drive-thru, I want the holiday pie, of course. You may recall that the apple pie comes in a green box.
Right.
All the other pies come in a brown one, and it's just marked like special pie. I got a cherry pie, not the holiday pie.
How did I screw this up?
Right, and these are all different McDonald's. This is not the same one. You know, it's always like when I'm on the road somewhere, I've got like an hour or two drive in front of me, and I'm like, I'm going to get like a hot chocolate and a holiday pie, and I'm really going to enjoy myself here. Three of them, right? Frozen one, cold one, cherry one. Like, what are the odds of this?
It's a Christmas miracle.
So, yesterday, I'm driving back from my hometown of Reading, PA, and I thought, you know how I'm going to cap off Christmas? Holiday pie. Holiday pie. And I stopped at three McDonald's. The first one, they were out. They said, no, we're already out of them. And the next two I stopped at, they looked like they were open, but they were actually closed. Like all the lights, like the signboard are on, so you think from the highway, oh, it's open. But then you get into the drive-through chute, and it's actually they're all closed. And I was like, what is this trick? Like, turn the lights off. So I've been completely thwarted. Other than the first one, I started off the holiday pie season strong. Like, it's been incredible calamity. And I want to conclude with this thought, right? Over the years, and I eat a lot of fast food. I do. I don't think Clayton does, but I do. There's probably no single place where I've gotten the wrong stuff more than at McDonald's. And yet, I don't know what this says about us as people or Americans or consumers. You take this for what you want. But never, ever have I even once thought to myself, I'm never going to a McDonald's again. That never crosses my mind.
You're so disappointed. But you would do this with other customer service, wouldn't you?
Right. That's what I'm saying, right? Like, let's say whatever. You know, you had a horrible experience with any other thing, like any other thing, you would at least for a moment think to yourself, I'm never doing business with those people again, right?
Right.
But never with McDonald's. And I don't know why it is. If you just know, like, probably by the next time I come to this one, the whole staff will have turned over anyway.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because you're going to have the same crappy food. It's not like it's any different, right? It's still going to be the same stuff. So the only thing that will change is you're not being able to get it.
Well,
like, they just won't be, they won't get into the bag. Like, you'll get down the street.
Right, and
you're
yes, that's the issue.
There are no fries in here. I ordered these fries. They're just not even in here.
Right. That's the issue. Like, that's one thing I appreciate about the McDonald's experience is the consistency. Because
whether good or bad.
Well, this is true, and I really developed this especially when I traveled. Chicken McNuggets from a McDonald's in Mexico tastes the same as the ones in Canada, tastes the same as the ones in Japan, tastes the same as the ones in Germany. I know what I'm getting when I order chicken McNuggets.
It's certainly not chicken. Whatever it is, it's consistent.
Yeah, you could say whatever you want about it, but you can't knock the consistency. Right. The issue is, does it get into my bag? That's the real issue. Because you can say holiday pie, and you'll get a frozen one, you'll get a cold one, you'll get a cherry pie, or you won't get one at all. So, yeah, I'm like one for seven or eight tries
this
year.
But, to me, there are those items on the McDonald's menu which I find are a little peripheral. And I think
the pies
make it into that sort of peripheral vision of items, if you will.
Really?
That is – you know, you see what I'm on to here? Like,
no, I don't get you yet. Keep going.
There are those main menu items, right? The Big Mac being the biggest seller, right? Fries and a Coke. Mm-hmm. That's what you get when you go through the drive-thru. And I think some of these other, maybe peripheral, well, maybe ancillary, some of these little items that they sell, but they don't really sell a lot of. But they're on the menu, and the staff doesn't necessarily have them ready to go because they just don't sell enough of them in high volume to have like the quarter pounder with cheese ready to go. They've got – you know, I would also say the filet of fish is in that realm too. Like if you go – I love the filet of fish.
That is a foul creation. Oh, come on.
I love the filet of fish.
You and I are going to go a couple rounds on this. I think that's one of the grossest concoctions ever, but go ahead.
I think it's right up there, right? Because it's like some weird pollock fish that's like ground up. So it's like those original chicken nuggets. They aren't really chicken. Like, you don't even know what's in it. They're just like ground up and shoved inside of a crust, right?
A fish might have overseen the making of the Filet-O-Fish, but he's like, its involvement is indirect at best.
Exactly. Like, these are...
Who's laying that 1/3 slice of cheese across the top? And that's Velveeta, right? It's not even real cheese.
Who knows what kind of cheese? Even my wife, she's like, that's not even real cheese. It's like a rubber. It's like a rubber cheese. And I'm like, yeah, I know.
Get in my belly.
But I do love that fillet of fish. And so, and it's weird that it's, you know, I don't know what type of fish it is. I think it is this weird, like, white pollock that's, like, farm-raised and, you know, and ground up. It's not really
it's not even underwater. It's grown on a farm.
Right. Like, if you, like, it wears overalls, it uses a pitchfork. It's not even actually in the water.
Right. Yeah, he has a straw hat on.
with a piece of hay sticking out of his mouth.
Growing fillets here.
I got to get out here and harvest these fillets. You know, the government provides me a farm subsidy for my fillet of fish. We're going to go to a fillet of fish farm. Yeah, where are we going? We're going to Alaska? See this thing? No. We're going to Nebraska.
Yeah. We grow them landlocked.
Do you ever see that, by the way, on the Dirty Jobs? You know, what is that guy's name that does the Dirty Jobs show?
I know who you mean because he's also like a car spokesman, but I don't know what his name is.
He once went to a tilapia farm, fish farm. No, it was maybe like a salmon farm, but they use... And it was in, like, the middle of the desert. And they had these big vats, and that's where they grew them. Like, there was no water for, like, hundreds of miles, and yet they were growing these fish in these big vats, like, right in the middle of the desert.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So, the fillet of fish is sort of a peripheral menu item for McDonald's because if you go there at sort of, like, an off-peak hour... Mm-hmm. You're guaranteed to get a few items, right? They always got chicken nuggets in the hopper.
Yeah.
Those are easy, right? You rip open the bag, frozen nuggets, throw that in the thing, drops down, you're done. Now they've got that, like, mechanical fry thing, so you don't even need, like, someone to fill them up. They just, like, have them rotating on this giant mechanical thing.
I don't think I've seen that.
Fries, also, ready to go, right? Quarter pounder with cheese, typically ready to go, the quarter pounder meat.
Sure, all the big sellers. Hamburger, right. Cheeseburger, quarter pounder with cheese, Big Mac. Those are usually ready any time of day.
Perhaps the McChicken, sometimes. Mm-hmm. Depends. And those are pretty easy to make, right? You pull out the patty, throw it right in the hopper, and you can cook that too, just like the fillet of fish. But I would say if you're going off hours, fillet of fish, not necessarily ready to go. They don't keep that just kind of on.
That one, well, you know, of those, the fillet of fish's shelf life is shorter than most of the others because of that tartar sauce.
Ah.
So if you remember, you know, every couple of hours, if you had to clean the bin out, you know, you know what I'm talking about, the little chute there where they come down from the grill guy.
Right.
That has a name, doesn't it? I can't think of it.
I don't know.
I don't know.
It's like a warming shelf or something.
Right. The Filet-O-Fishes turn over a lot faster. So you're chucking them, you know, a cheeseburger could sit there maybe for 4 hours without being purchased, but not a Filet-O-Fish.
Yeah. And the Filet-O-Fish, you know, of course they squirt the tartar sauce on the top of its deliciousness. but I would have to say that the pies are not ready to go, and they take a long time to bake.
Yeah. They make, you know, you would make a big batch when you're turning over for lunch, and then you load them into that pie warmer. And if no one's watching, because if you remember what that cabinet's like, right, you can only see the bottom where the three pies are dispensed. The rest of it is opaque. So inside, you could be running out of the pies, and if no one opens the warmer up to look, you don't know. And then, as Clayton pointed out, for you to make another batch is time-consuming.
Yeah.
That is probably the slowest of the fast foods.
Have you ever heard the Filet-O-Fish commercial, by the way, is one of my favorite commercials of all time.
I don't know that I've heard it.
I'm going to play it for you right now.
Oh.
Here, you probably recognize this. I love this commercial.
Get your own crispy golden fillet of fish, especially now when you can get one with medium fries and a nice cold soft drink for just $3.99.
You've actually sung that song to me at times.
Give me back the filet of fish. Because they're just sitting in this garage, and like this, suddenly the fish on the wall just starts singing. He's pissed that the guy's eating a filet of fish next to him. And actually, I think Bed Bath & Beyond started selling that type of wall-mounted fish. Mm. Like it was the filet of fish one, and it would sing that song.
Wow.
I asked my wife if I could get that for our living room, mm-hmm. and she hung up on the phone. So would you agree? And I'm curious because I was looking up this will be the Wikipedia episode, because we're looking to see like the history of the Filet-O-Fish. And I was also curious like when the holiday pies, or just when the pies in general, came onto the scene.
To me, there's like a classic set of McDonald's offerings, and they're all encapsulated in that jingle that I think is from maybe the late 70s, where you sing all the things on the menu. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Right. Yeah, I know what you mean.
And it ends with like milkshakes and apple pies. Like the fact that apple pie was part of that, along with Filet-O-Fish and Big Mac, like those are the classic McDonald's items to me. So I'll choose to disagree with you in that I think those are the periphery. To me, the periphery are all the things that have come later as McDonald's attempts to reclaim some of the lost fast food marketplace, right? Like as Chick-fil-A became more and more of a competitor, they introduced that Southern-style chicken sandwich, which is, you know, a chicken sandwich with pickles on it, which is exactly like, you know, what you can get, except not half as tasty, but exactly like the one Chick-fil-A sells.
Yeah,
you know, they introduced the McCafe stuff as like an answer to Starbucks encroaching on, you know, their part of the fast food marketplace. So all that type of stuff that's like McDonald's answering a competitor to me is the periphery material.
Hmm. So this one was created in 1962.
The holiday pie?
No, the filet of fish.
Oh, I was going to say, wow.
And it was created in 1962 by Lou Grone. He owned a McDonald's in a predominantly Roman Catholic neighborhood where the Catholic customers would not eat meat on Fridays. And so they wanted to come in there on the 60s and wanted to have something else. And so he created this menu item. And it's interesting because then I guess Ray Kroc made a deal with Grone that they would sell two non-meat sandwiches on a Friday. Kroc's mm-hmm. own Hula Burger, which was mm-hmm. grilled pineapple with cheese on a cold bun.
Wow.
And the filet of fish. And whichever sold the most would be added to the permanent menu. It's mm-hmm. no surprise, of course, that the filet of fish won hands down and was added to menus throughout 1963 and then finally reached nationwide in 65.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But it wasn't until so farmed fish weren't used in it until 1981.
Mm-hmm.
So they originally used cod before mm-hmm. Using some of this pollock. Interesting. Wow. I'm going to look up holiday pie now.
I've never even heard of – I'm aware of Jackson Pollock, the painter, but I was not aware that was a fish. So I
Yeah, he's all over the place, just like Jackson Pollock was.
Right, yeah. I have like a mental image of what he looks like. He's got that milkweed sticking out of his mouth. You know, he's a hardworking agrarian type.
Yeah.
Didn't you once tell me, either you or maybe it was Natalie, found that there was like a forum where they discuss McDonald's pies?
Oh, yeah. There's a McDonald's holiday. There's a McDonald's pie forum where people like talk about.
If they need a blogger, well, I've got a story to adapt for them about my holiday pie experience.
I read reviews. I read reviews of it. I mean,
yeah,
that's the thing. I mean, I read reviews of these different pies that they had listed there, and
that was the evidence needed to convince Clayton that they did in fact exist.
I mean, it's funny. You get the consistency though, and like my wife, like she consistently gets sick every time we eat a McDonald's. So on the way home from like when we're driving up down from the Poconos, like there's the only restaurant sort of nearby. There's like that and a Subway or something like that. And so we'll swing in there and get some breakfast sometimes. She's like, I always feel sick after eating there. She's like, we're not eating there anymore on this drive. So you know, it's weird because if you think about. Like, if I got sick every time I ate at a restaurant, I would never eat there again. But you're right. Like, something about McDonald's, you're like, that's all right. I'll deal with the stomach pain or feeling a little weird after eating one of their hamburgers, knowing that it's coated in ammonia. Mm. That's all right. But we do it because it's just easy. And it is tasty.
Yeah.
We just suffer the pain later.
This is all true. Hey, listen, I've really got to go blow my nose. So while I'm gone, Clayton's going to do some talking.
I am. I'm going to tell you about our good friends over at Drobo, makers of a whole lineup of brand new redundant hard drives. And I'm particularly excited today because, well, first of all, sitting here on the floor next to me is the Drobo 5D. And if you're wondering, what in the world is a Drobo? First of all, it's redundant storage. So what that means is it has multiple hard drives inside of the large container unit. And it's not even that large, really. It's like the size of a shoebox. But all of your digital life can be stored here. So if you're running a normal computer, your laptop, whatever, keep your photos, your family videos on backup, all of your documents. You can do complete mirror images of your current computer. Running a full-time machine backup, if you're using a Macintosh or one of your PCs, you can do a full backup onto the Drobo. And what's great is you never have to worry about drive failure. So if one of the drives dies, you've got four or even five other drives inside of the Drobo that has all of your data safe. So if it says, hey, this drive has just died, you can buy or swap out a drive, pop it right out, pop out the dead drive, put a brand new drive right in, and all of your data is safe, and it starts to use that new drive as an extension of its body. Almost think of it like a lizard. You know, you cut off its tail, and one of the drives dies. It doesn't matter. The lizard's not dying. Just grows that tail back. You know, you just get more drive space. And it's expandable up to 20 terabytes for the Drobo. It's fantastic. So I'm really excited because I just got my brand new iMac today. It has Thunderbolt capabilities, which means, you know, lightning fast connections between the iMac and the Drobo 5D, which also has a lightning port. And it also has USB 3.0, the fastest of the USB lines. So for data transfers, I'll be taking a lot of photos, and I'm going to store my entire photo library on the Drobo. And I cannot wait. No latency whatsoever. So that means I can be editing photos in Photoshop, but they're being stored externally off of my computer on the Drobo 5D. It's that simple. And I should mention, I actually just got off the phone with Drobo Tech Support just a short time ago because I was curious, hey, if I have the old 4-bay Drobo from years ago and I want to upgrade to the 5D, what do I do with those all my hard drives? Do I have to reformat them and back my data up somewhere else? And they told me, nope. Just make sure your firmware is up to date on both of your Drobos, the new one and the old one. Power them down, pop the drives out, put them in the new Drobo, fire it up, and you're good to go. So I don't need to do any finagling of all my old data. You can swap it right over to the brand new Drobo. I'm telling you, we don't back up enough in this country. So do that for your New Year's resolution. Start backing up all of your family photos and videos and personal documents because you never know when you could lose it all. And the Drobo protects against that. Go to Drobo.com, that's Drobo.com, and check out the Drobo 5D today. They've got a whole lineup of other ones over there too, but check out the Drobo 5D. That's the one I just got.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, I watched the show, and it's called Arrow. I watched it mostly because Clayton sent it to me. You know what this is about? It's about Green Arrow, Clayton.
It is. And so if you're not familiar with Arrow, it just launched this year. It was just picked up for the full season. Oliver Queen, of course, who is Green Arrow, is played by Stephen Amell. I was reading his Twitter stream when after the first few episodes, it became such a hit on the CW network that he tweeted, a good thing to wake up on a Monday morning to learn that we've been picked up for the full season. And these were episodes they had already filmed. So All of that work would have like gone down the toilet, had it not been picked up. I wonder, though, would it have been featured on – or would they have like sold a DVD box set of a full season if it never got picked up? Would we ever see the light of day of those?
I guess
episodes?
It depends if it's been post-produced or not. You know, some of those, like, you know, they get canceled before they air all of them, and then the DVD box set is when it all comes out. I'm pretty sure that's what happened with Birds of Prey, right? Like, they had a couple unaired episodes. They got canned early on, and their DVD box set was the first that it all came to light.
But, right.
And Arrow is, you know, this is really the third, if not fourth, adventure into this general direction. You know, it used to be the WB, and then it became the CW. That's where Smallville started, which was kind of like a reimagining maybe of a younger Superman. It's Clark Kent's story. And that did really, really well. That's one of the longest-running science fiction genre television shows in history. And then they attempted to replicate this with Birds of Prey, which is a collection of DC heroines, including Barbara Gordon, the former Batgirl who's now Oracle, the Huntress, and for whatever reason in this one, it was like the Black Canary's daughter rather than the Black Canary. And it was kind of in the same style as the early Smallvilles, right? It was like a Monster of the Week type show. You know, it's like, here's three pretty girls, and, you know, it's set in the Batman side of the DC universe, but it really didn't do well. It didn't attract an audience, and it died.
I'm surprised that Smallville survived. Maybe it was because it was the first of those shows like that, and people just gave them enough of a pass. Because if you look at those early episodes from season one of Smallville, you'll notice that, yes, they are Monster of the Week. So you had the you know, the green meteorite infestation and all of these different freaks, you know, and Clark would have to deal with them in every episode. And it was the same formula in every episode of season one, just about. And I think till the finale of season one. And then, like, season two, they switched it up quite a bit. But I think that was probably the failure of Birds of Prey.
Yeah.
Was trying to do that same thing with sort of the monsters of the week.
Right. You know, instead of them being meteor freaks, they were called metahumans, and they were developing superpowers and that sort of thing. And see, Smallville had a very good-looking cast, right? You know, the guy who played Clark Kent and the girl who played Lana Lang. Like, these are the kind of people you put on magazine covers and that kind of thing. And,
right.
I'm not knocking. Obviously, they felt like the girl that played the Huntress on Birds of Prey was the one they were going to tie all the marketing around, because she was the face of that show. She, every bit of marketing they did, it was a picture of the Huntress.
Right.
But it got, I think it got most of its season out, but then it just kind of crumbled. Then they attempted to, do you remember, I think it was called Mercy Reef was the name of it. They did a pilot for what would have been like the Smallville version of Aquaman.
Now, I thought it was called Aquaman because I have that first episode of Aquaman.
Well, when they, you know, they released it then, years went by and they released that. You could get it as a digital download like an iTunes or something.
Right.
And they may have just called it Aquaman then so people knew what it was. But like Smallville, which, you know, if you don't know your Superman mythos to the layperson, well, what the heck is that show about? You wouldn't know. And I'm pretty sure it was Mercy Reef was the name of it. It's a young Arthur Curry. Like, these are the teenage foibles of the guy who will one day be Aquaman, in the same way that Smallville were, you know, it's the teenage foibles of the man who will one day be Superman. And this thing never got beyond the pilot. They made the pilot. It might have aired once, maybe not, and then it surfaced years later, and you saw it.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. I watched it on an airplane. I downloaded the episode from iTunes and threw it on my old iPod, you know, video at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was not good.
Right.
It was pretty terrible. But it has, you know, it's funny. It pulls. I think they were like testing the waters, so to speak, on what they then did with Arrow. I think some of the things that were, they tried with Birds of Prey and they tried with Aquaman, a.k.a. Mercy Reef, wound up working out on Arrow. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you have the young, hot-looking actors. You know, they're in good shape. You have an interesting premise where they have some sort of tragedy, you know, mm-hmm. befalls them at the beginning. You have a hot group of friends, kind of, you know, helps them figure it all out. Teenage angst, and you know, with a mix of, like, I think you described sort of like the Hills. You know,
yeah,
mixed in with it, and maybe
that's very much what I think Arrow is. I think it's the Hills meet Smallville.
Yeah, you know, with Aquaman, it was just weird. And first of all, I didn't think he was a compelling lead character at all. I thought he was kind of blah.
You mean the actor, or just that it was Aquaman?
Well, both. I think, who cares? I don't want to see a guy in the water the whole show where he can't speak. So I think that makes it difficult, right? And it was odd, I think, cinematically trying to pull off these computer generated graphics where he's constantly like doing weird things in the water and using sharks and different things like that, and all of his crimes, all the crimes that he was going to try to solve and deal with, always going to have to be near water, right? Mm-hmm. Just didn't seem right. Although it seemed like the formula was there, right? You're going to have a lot of chicks walking around in bikinis. Mm-hmm. Right, they're gonna always kind of be near the beach.
That's probably how they sold it. They're like, we got a bunch of people that look great in swimsuits.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it was, right? But then when you realize, like, it's about him trying to be like an environmentalist saving sea turtles, and he's not really. It just was weird, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it just didn't really take off. But here in Arrow, you have like sort of fast-paced action. Because I think in Smallville, one of the downsides of Smallville was you really wanted to see Clark in Superman action. Mm-hmm. And if you add up the scenes like in those shows, they're like 30 seconds total, you know, mm-hmm. of him doing anything action-related. Mostly it's him dealing with relationship, with Lana or with Lois and those sorts of things. But with Arrow, there's a lot of action right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be sure. It is, like I said, I mean, this is at least their fourth attempt. Who knows? There might have been other ones that didn't get as far along as the ones that we know about. But they've really tried to get this right for a while. And Smallville is, you know, which is where they really introduced Green Arrow in this way. Now, that Green Arrow was played by Justin Hartley. In Smallville. But he ended up being, probably after Clark, the second most predominant, like, protagonist character that they had in terms of the superheroes. You know, Chloe Sullivan was always kind of a constant in that series. And it's just interesting, of everyone in the DC universe, that somehow Green Arrow's the one that they went with.
Is it because it's the easiest? I mean, here in the show, and I don't know my Green Arrow canon perhaps, like you do, but you know, the premise is that he is shipwrecked.
Mm-hmm.
In the pilot episode, Oliver Queen is shipwrecked. He's with a lady on a yacht with his dad and some other people in their big yacht, and they're out and floating around the Pacific Ocean. And a big storm comes up, and they shipwreck. Mm-hmm. And I think he's like the only survivor, and he winds up on this island for 5 years. And he's just like, you know, it's like Castaway.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on this island for like 5 years, and he's trying to figure out like how to survive. And becomes, you know, guy sort of – we're starting to see that in some of these early episodes. This guy sort of takes him under his wing, who's almost like Green Arrow himself. He's great with a bow and arrow. He's on his island. He shoots him with an arrow at one point. You know, he winds up in his cave, and he starts like kind of teaching him and I think training him, and he becomes an incredible marksman, I guess.
Right.
Is that what – and then he comes back to Starling City, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Vowing to sort of return the city to its former glory. And, you know, his father has sort of entrusted him to do this and sort of make up for his wrongs that his father had done while he was, you know, rich and rich little playboy.
There are parts of it that are consistent with Green Arrow. There are parts that are not. You know, like, why did Star City have to be Starling City? Like, that seems like a strange choice.
Right.
His family was never really... In the Green Arrow stuff I read, his parents were like a non-factor. Most of the, like, up until the arrival of the modern age of comic books, most of the origin tellings for Green Arrow are consistent in that he shipwrecked on a deserted island and had to teach himself archery in order to survive. So they're taking bits of that, and then they're kind of taking their liberties with it in the course of this series. In later retellings, they have changed Green Arrow's origin a few times. And they've even gone so far, this might be as recent as the New 52 type stuff, where they've almost explained that the reason that there are three or four different potential origins for Green Arrow, they're saying that maybe some of them were like hallucinations that he had, and that he really, you know, didn't end up on a deserted island, or they try to explain away some of the other ones. And I'm not as up on that stuff as I once was, but the main issue, I think, with Green Arrow... I think you touched on one thing, right? He doesn't have superpowers. He's the easiest. Like, it's not like when they did The Flash,
right.
You know? It's not like trying to do Green Lantern. Green Arrow, if you got a bow and an arrow and you can do that, you know, what's any different from making an episode of CSI or Law and Order in that regard? The special effects are minimal to do Green Arrow.
You've got probably plenty of stunt guys in Hollywood that can don a a hood so you can't see their face. A crop of acrobats you can probably pull from Cirque du Soleil, and having them doing backflips off of walls, you know, in a green hood. So it's probably highly inexpensive.
Yeah. It, as it relates to producing a superhero show, and they don't really make it like an overt superhero show,
right?
I think.
If anything, you know, I mean, he's really a vigilante, and it's not really about him having superpowers in any kind of way.
Right. Nor does he. You know, Green Arrow doesn't. But I think... Green Arrow for years and years was always kind of knocked as he was too much like Batman. You know, they are, if you look at like the classic Justice League, they're the two guys that don't have powers, and they have remarkably similar backstories. They're both rich kids, heirs to giant fortunes. They both use caves as their headquarters. Like, Batman has the Batmobile, and Green Arrow has the Arrow car. Like, there's, you know, there's Robin, there's Speedy. There was an uncanny parallelism between Batman and Green Arrow. The thing is, of course, is Batman's probably maybe the most sought-after license in all of superhero-dom, whereas Green Arrow really isn't. So you can do some of the kinds of things, because you know that young Bruce Wayne series is something that they had talked about time and time again while Smallville was still on the air. Are they going to introduce a young Bruce Wayne? What would he be like if he showed up in Smallville? Could he sustain a series of his own? Well, here you have a character where if you really wanted to push those buttons, can be almost exactly like that, except without having to deal with the Batman license. Because chances are, nobody's really chasing down the Green Arrow license, you know?
Right.
He was, for years, considered not even a second stringer, but a third stringer. I found out some interesting information about cartoons and animation. I know you and I thought we were going to end up talking about music a lot in this episode, and well, we really haven't. But so I'll tell you this. You know, I was fascinated by what was the process when they were putting the Super Friends together, that after you got the big three, Aquaman became number four. Like, he doesn't seem like the logical next choice at all, does he?
Right.
Like, why isn't it the Flash? Why isn't it Plastic Man, who had, you know, greater, you know, fame and notoriety, I think. I think people who aren't even comic book fans know who Plastic Man is. How did they end up with Aquaman, right? Like, that's such a strange choice. And the answer to that is they had to come up with a team of people that didn't necessarily need to have on-screen violence to resolve things. In those, you know, if you watch the first couple iterations of the Super Friends, there's never a punch thrown. There's never a kick. There's never a gun fired. There's never a weapon used like that. You know, the only weapons are like, you know, the batarangs and the magic lasso that go around people and tie them up. And Green Arrow shoots people with arrows, you know. He makes one appearance in the first season of Super Friends. He has a cameo in that same season that Plastic Man and the Atom have cameos.
Yeah.
And then Green Arrow disappears. He's gone until Justice League happens decades later. But during that time, Green Arrow in the comic books actually became something. He became a very outspoken, in terms of his politics, which was really uncharacteristic of comic book characters. He almost became like this friendly antagonist for Hawkman in the Justice League. Like, he would always like bring out the worst in Hawkman. He was big on fighting for racial equality, especially in that like landmark Neil Adams Green Lantern, Green Arrow, the hard-traveling heroes era. And Green Arrow kind of became something. But it really isn't until the last 10 or 15 years that he's become even a B-lister for DC. He was brought back to prominence by the Justice League cartoon, where he really got a lot of play, and then by becoming a supporting cast member on Smallville and kind of stealing the show. And I think all of those things and his similarities to Batman have resulted in Arrow, which apparently is doing pretty well, right? It's like the number two on the CW network.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the pilot, I was looking at some numbers last week. The pilot had 4.1 million viewers on a CW show. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
and it's tricked down a little bit to like 3.5 million, but still 3.5 million viewers. And it went back up close to 4 million again towards the end of the season. So I think they just wrapped up. On December 12th, they just wrapped up their last episode of the season. The split season. It'll be back in January, mid-January, starting up like episodes 10 through 16.
Mm-hmm.
It's been widely received pretty well. Of like the top number of critics, a lot of people said it's received favorable reviews. You know, it's got sort of an interesting direction and a quality look to it that I think some of these other shows have been missing. I'm really surprised at how well some of the fight scenes are executed. A lot of the arrow trickery, a lot of the things that he's doing in some of the battle scenes are really well done. And they're not sort of scrimping when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah. I've only watched the first four episodes and you know, the fights are great. You know, it's well done. You know, it's a good-looking cast, all those kinds of things. It is a little hard to believe at times. I think it probably does well, maybe, or I don't know. We don't live in the era anymore, I think, where there's a stigma to superhero shows. But Because they don't hit you over the head with the superhero elements, I think it probably doesn't drive off the type of audience that would take umbrage with that. You know, the idea that all he does is put like a streak of green paint across his eyes and a hood on, like, I'm having a hard time believing that people just don't look at his face and be like, oh yeah, it's you, Oliver Queen, the guy that's on the front page of the newspaper all the time anyway.
Right.
But
of course, I guess we give a pass to, you know, Clark Kent putting on glasses.
So it's all right. It was interesting to note the love interest, I think, who is Dinah Laurel Lance is the character, which is the name of the Black Canary, if you're curious, is played by Keith Partridge's daughter. You know, David Cassidy, the actor from the Partridge family, his daughter plays the chief love interest, and she had come up before because there was a time when Clayton and I watched a briefly run program, also on CBS, incidentally, called Harper's Island.
Yeah, her name is...
She was the lead actress.
Yeah, Katie Cassidy. If you watched Harper's Island, it was that, like, what, seven-part series on CBS that was only meant to be. It was just supposed to be, like, this one-run thing. There was going to be no continuation of it. And it was a kind of an interesting concept. I don't think they'd ever really done that before. I mean, other than, like, a mini-series. But, yeah, and she... so she played the chick who was getting married in that show.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of like, I don't know, Scream reimagined as a summer replacement.
Yeah. Oh, it just started snowing here. Well, the storm is coming. It's time to
Yeah.
So anyway, so are you going to think you're going to continue watching Arrow?
You know, this is right up my alley, but I don't know that I want to go out of my way. Like, so far, well, it's enjoyable. This is definitely not the kind of show where I'm like, I gotta know what happens next. And I know that a lot of other DC characters show up as the series goes on. Like, I've seen spoilers online, like the Huntress is gonna show up, or, you know, this person's gonna show up, or that person. And apparently in one of the episodes yet to air, the guy who's generally thought of as Green Arrow's arch nemesis, Count Vertigo, shows up.
Yeah.
So, I'm kind of interested. I'm kind of interested, but I don't think I'm gonna go out of my way, you know.
Yeah, there's a couple. I mean, Deadshot is in it. Deathstroke is in it.
Yeah, I did see Deadshot, and I saw in one of the island flashbacks a guy that looked like Deathstroke.
Yeah.
So, it's cool, you know, that's interesting.
What's interesting to me is, of course, like the, you know, Smallville, there was like no killing, you know, or if there was, it was inadvertent, I guess. Maybe by the meteor freaks or those sorts of individuals who were, you know, out for blood. But it was pretty tame. By television standards, violence standards. This show doesn't pull any punches, though. Like Deadshot taking dead aim on some individual, shooting him with a, you know, high-powered rifle from across a building somewhere. Arrow himself firing all kinds of arrows into people and killing them. So not only and the police are out for him because he's a vigilante and they're trying to arrest him. They don't know who he is. Who's this mysterious guy with a bow and arrow? And he's killing, you know, he's... But he's basically a serial killer in this show, right? I mean, he's killing people left and right.
Yeah, it's definitely a reflection of the darker interpretations of Green Arrow. Like, really after, I guess it was Mike Grell who did Green Arrow Long Bow Hunter.
Right.
And that was a series where, an interesting thing about that, they always downplayed the superhero elements. He's never in costume. No one ever calls him Green Arrow. Long Bow Hunter was really very, very dark. And then... You know, right before they rebooted everything with the New 52, Green Arrow did become morally a little more ambiguous. The villain who maimed his partner, Roy Harper, he murders him in cold blood. So Green Arrow, you know, he headed that after years and years. I mean, decades and decades of storytelling, he headed in that direction anyway. And maybe those darker elements are what appealed to the creators behind this series.
And Mike Grell, of course, I remember this from Comic-Con this past year, but they handed out like a 10-page preview comic that someone got their hands on and was able to show me because I wasn't at Comic-Con this past year. But Mike Grell did the cover of that preview comic for Arrow at Comic-Con this year. And it really set the tone. It really set the tone for what this series has become. So interesting. I'm into it. I'm enjoying it. I sort of put it on in the background. I'll throw it on like Hulu on my iPad while I'm doing some work and catch an episode here and there. So. I'm not as sucked in as I was to Smallville. Although I have to say, you know, when watching Smallville season one, I don't feel like I was sucked into that much either.
No, I gave up on it for years. Like until they started introducing some of the other characters, like a Flash-like character showed up or an Aquaman-like character showed up. But then that was like season six when that started to happen. I just didn't watch. Like it was too formulaic.
Yeah. I mean, I got into it in a few seasons after that. I really didn't care about the first season of that. And so you have to think, okay, they've got most of – and I don't know if they've finished writing and they're filming the rest of the season yet, you know. But when it was picked up, you know, they think that they had the formula they were going to win with, right? And then it was picked up, so they had the other episodes in the can. So they can't really make any sort of mid-season changes, go back and film episode 5 again, right? It's already in the can. They just got to air it. So now I think, you know, with some of the critical response of them tightening it up a bit, making it a little bit more sharpened, you know, just a little bit more focused, a little bit more Batman-like, and just tighten things up a bit, it could be a hit in season 2. Mm-hmm. It's good news, though, that they picked it up and they took a chance on it.
I think so. Well, while I was doing some television research, I came across some other information that might interest you and I. Part of the reason I was doing this was because every once and again I like to watch a show called Toy Hunter on the Travel Channel, which is about this toy dealer from New Jersey who's named Jordan. And he travels the U.S. and he goes through people's collections of junk and he finds old toys that he, you know, he buys from them and then takes them back and resells them for a profit. And this is not an overly interesting thing, but he's a very, like, television-friendly guy. He's got a great smile. He's got a charisma to him. He's kind of funny. And because, you know, a guy that goes around and looks through people's basements and buys toys doesn't really scream successful television series to me. On the other hand, I don't watch Storage Wars, so maybe it is. But I do watch Toy Hunter from time to time, and in the episode I just happened to see, he actually thought finding mint-in-the-box Sky Commanders was a find.
Really?
He paid this guy $25 for 2 mint-in-the-box Sky Commanders, which he then turned around and sold for $60. But just the fact that, like, Sky Commanders were on TV in 2012, I was like, whoa, what's going on here? So
that's awesome.
He talked a little bit about he at times claims to have knowledge that I know he doesn't have. For example, when he refers to the DC Comics villain Darkseid, like, I think you mean Darkseid. So every once and again, like, he makes a mistake like that, but he does seem to know a lot of information. And one of the things that he puts out there was that he quickly tells the origin of why the Sky Commanders are called the Sky Commanders, like how they got that name. And I thought, that doesn't sound right to me. So, of course, I jumped right on Wikipedia and started looking around at related stuff. And I came across this interesting nugget of information. Well, two of them. One is, you will recall that the shows that we really enjoyed watching, like Transformers, G.I. Joe, and one of the other ones that was in this was The Visionaries.
Right.
Were produced by Sunbow Productions. Like, I can even picture the flash screen of their company that would come up at the end of the cartoons. It was like a blue screen with a sun in the middle, and the letters would fan out.
Right.
Sunbow Productions. At the end of 1987, they had the license, or the contract, I guess is what I want to say, to produce all of these. And they did them in conjunction with Marvel's Animation Studio. Transformers, G.I. Joe, and The Visionaries were part of this deal as well. Well, at the end of 1987, they didn't renew the contract, and that's why all those series ended. They never came back in 1988, and it killed the whole second wave of Visionaries that were in pre-production to come out. There were another dozen characters that were going to be released, all of this kind of stuff. It just killed the Visionaries. The people that were doing the other ends of it, because they were all at that point, once the regulations had changed, right, these kinds of things were launched across numerous platforms. G.I. Joe wasn't just a cartoon. It was an action figure line. It was a comic book, et cetera, et cetera. The Visionaries, there was a comic book. There was the action figure line. You know, there was the cartoon as well. When Sunbow lost the contract, all of these ended en masse. There was no more Transformers on TV. There was no more G.I. Joe. Now, they did come back in later incarnations, but I mean, those runs that we watched in the 80s, that's when they ended. And the Visionaries were a casualty of that. I never knew that before. I thought that was interesting. It was interesting reading about what the second wave of the Visionaries would have been like if they had been able to produce them. And this interesting bit of information also came to light. Do you remember the mask commercials where in the commercial there were like live action mask guys?
Yes.
Like a real rhino truck would drive up to a gas station and someone would get out.
Yes. Absolutely remember those.
The reason for those and the reason why there was a commercial for the G.I. Joe comic book but not for some of the other stuff was there was a regulation that said a television commercial for toys or whatever could have no more than like 10 seconds of animation in it. It was somehow against the FCC guideline. So they had to make them live action. Like, you couldn't, even though there was a mask cartoon, you couldn't use more than a few seconds of it in the commercial. So rather than do that, they did those live action ones. And as a way around it, because G.I. Joe the comic book was classified differently, in the G.I. Joe comic book commercials, they could use the clips from the cartoon, but not when advertising the toys because of the FCC regulations in the 80s.
So they had to use live action instead. That's kind of crazy. I was right. Looking recently. I didn't realize, and you and I had talked about this on the Grizz. Actually, why don't we take a moment here and one of the things, one of our next show sponsor, and we'll just spend a few more minutes here before we wrap things up. I got something to say, though, about some DVD stuff. So why don't you tell us about our friends over at Cobra, and I will pull up some research.
Okay. I would be delighted to tell you about Cobra. And I'll tell you why. Because they've been great friends of us here at Grizzly Productions for more than a year now, going on 2 years, actually. And it's because of great show sponsors like them that we're able to deliver this content to you free of charge week in and week out. Not just the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, but Daddy on Board and other podcasts in our network. So you can help Clayton and I by going over to Cobra.com and taking a look at the array of incredible innovations they have over there, all of which are designed with this in mind. Making your life simpler. And you've got about a week left to take advantage of this. Take a look, just for example, at like the 36 items in the specials section over at Cobra.com. Free shipping on all of their best-selling items through January 4th, I think it is. So you don't have very long to take advantage of this. You can save big because tons of their bestsellers are on deep discount, right? I saw one of their radar detectors, $80 off the asking price. At least three or four of their very best sellers are buy one, get one free, so you can give something cool to somebody else and keep one for yourself. The folks over at Cobra.com, they make radar and laser detectors. They make navigation devices for professionals. If you're a truck driver or if you work on the water, you need marine navigation. You need reliable two-way talk radios and CBs and stuff like that, and all kinds of other tremendous solutions just as a general rule of thumb to simplify your existence. Then you owe it to yourself to go over to Cobra.com. And you'll be doing Clayton and I a great favor as well, because we want to keep our sponsors happy here at the Grizzly Productions Network. We can't make these shows without them. So do us a solid. Head over to Cobra.com right now. You'll be glad you did.
We thank them for their support. And I should, what I was saying before the break was, there are some DVD collections. Now, I didn't realize this because I had found these in another way, but the Sky Commanders and Mask episodes. Now, I think we talked about this on the show before, because the complete animated series, they now release them through these sort of manufacturer-on-demand releases.
Right. They just released Superboy Season 2 that way.
Wow.
The Warner Archive did.
Right. So Warner Archives has released Sky Commanders late this summer. Did you buy this? Are you aware of this?
No, I did not know this, and I don't know that I want it. But go ahead.
Yeah. I think you do want it. I really think you do want it. So, yeah, the Warner Archive had released them at the end of this summer. Sky Commanders, the complete series on DVD, as well as – and it was part of their Hanna-Barbera Classics collection, which I was reading a little bit about the Hanna-Barbera Classics collection as their most popular DVD releases. It's become like their the line that they began rolling out in 2004 has become one of their best-selling animation DVDs when they roll through these. And so if you just think about some of the popular ones, what are some of the popular ones you can think of off the top of your head that would be obvious?
From Hanna-Barbera?
Yeah.
Wow, like all those old ones that were on the USA Cartoon Express, right? Those were all Hanna-Barbera productions, weren't they?
Sure, like the the Yogi Bear show.
Yep, yeah, like the Laugh Olympics is always the one that kind of – because it was like all the Hanna-Barbera characters were all together in that one. But yeah, you know, Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear and
– yeah. So they released the Smurfs, Johnny Quest, Space Ghost and Dino Boy.
Right, yeah, all of those. The Galaxy Trio must have been Hanna-Barbera, the Herculoids, of course, Thundar the Barbarian, maybe.
Yeah.
No, Thundar might have been Filmation.
No, Thundar is a part of it as well, because I was looking at that as well. I think, is it Thundar? Maybe not. Wait a minute. I thought I saw that in here. Mr. T.
Oh, Mr. T. Why are you coaching a gymnastics team, Mr. T?
It's so bizarre.
Oh, I want to watch just one of those.
The Jetsons, of course. Yeah, Thundar the Barbarian, sure enough. Speed Buggy, Jabberjaw.
Speed Buggy, wow, yes.
Speed Buggy, what was that? That was from the 60s or the 70s? No, that had to be from the 70s, right?
Right. 70, Speed Buggy and Jabberjaw and the Great Grape Ape all kind of go together in my mind.
Yeah.
Clue Club, right?
McDuff. Remember the McDuff, the talking dog?
No, I don't remember that.
Josie and the Pussycats.
Right, yeah.
But the one that stood out to me, I remember watching this, and of course, Sky Commander's also from that era.
number one with a bullet.
Yeah, but, Snorks. You remember the Snorks?
Of course, yes, the Snorks.
But for me, one that stood out because I was obsessed with sort of video games of that era was Pac-Man.
Oh, yeah. Those were all Hanna-Barbera's, were they?
Yeah, they were Hanna-Barbera.
Pac-Man and Pole Position and Donkey Kong.
It was produced by Hanna-Barbera, and it was based, of course, on the video game by Namco. And it was on ABC, ran from 1982 to 1983. That's right in line. I think in Pac-Man Fever came out, the song was 1982, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They turned up the original run of them, the Pac-Man shows, had turned up on USA Cartoon Express on USA in the 1980s. And then the Cartoon Network in the 1990s. That's really the last time. I think it showed up on a Christmas special in 2005. But yeah, it's interesting. I'm trying to remember. I remember the animation of like the wife and like holding the little baby.
Sure.
You remember that?
Of course. Yeah, I used to watch Pac-Man.
Did we like it? I feel like we watched it because we knew we liked the video game. But, you know, the video game had no personality as it related to Pac-Man. He was just this yellow chomping thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that we really enjoyed that. Like, I kind of felt the same way about, do you remember Heathcliff, which was kind of like, you know, seemed like he wasn't quite as popular as Garfield, but was another orange cat.
Right, like a ripoff of,
Right, like Heathcliff, I think I just kind of watched him because he came on after Inspector Gadget. You know, like, I guess I'll watch Heathcliff. I didn't really like Heathcliff, but I watched him.
Wow, have you heard of this? Rockin' with Judy Jetson?
Nope.
It's a 1988 musical made-for-TV movie. Mm. Who thought that was a good idea?
I don't know. Hey, did you finish your Masters of the Universe Christmas special?
I did not. I did not. I got sidetracked. Did you end up watching that?
No, sir. But I because I became aware, someone told me that the second season of Superboy had been released as like a manufacturer-on-demand title, and I really did like that Superboy series that the Salkins did in the late 80s. Like, some of it's dreck, but I really did like that as a kid. I used to watch that back-to-back with My Secret Identity, which was, you know, the show that kind of launched Jerry O'Connell. And if My Secret Identity was available on DVD, I would totally have it.
I remember that, yeah. Challenge of the GoBots, the original miniseries.
That's one of the – that – oh, GoBots – man, that is the worst. Yeah. GoBots is the worst.
It really was.
The GoBots. The GoBots. That's the whole theme. I just did it for you.
Speaking of robots, I played recently Transformers Prime for the Nintendo Wii. The Nintendo Wii I got the other day.
Oh yeah. I think you're mistaken. I think
no, the Nintendo Wii U. I'm sorry.
Right.
Transformers Prime. I think is what it's called. Right. Yeah,
yeah, from the new animated series.
It's pretty good. It's really entertaining. You kind of kick it off as a bumblebee, and you're being attacked, trying to get this last craft out of the warring worlds before the Decepticons are like destroying the last way to get off this planet. Mm-hmm. And it's really well done. It's pretty fun. So they've done a good job with that. This is manufacturer on demand. Have you ever ordered anything manufacturer on demand like that?
I got one from the Warner Archive because I didn't realize that's what it was. They released the two-part Legends of the Superheroes special. This easily 2 or 3 years ago I did this. I mean, right when they released it. I pre-ordered it the day it became available because I couldn't believe they were releasing it. And then it came to my house, and it had like a form in it or whatever that said, you know, this is from the Warner Archive and it was burnt just for you, and it's, you know, they're not doing this in mass release. And so, yeah. And other than the disc is a little weird.
Was it well done? I mean, did it look like, was the production value good?
It is. It's the very best quality. It was filmed on video. It was never shot on film. So it's, you know, to begin, they did it as inexpensively as possible. You know, the costume, some of the costumes are kind of shoddy, I should say. I mean, it really did. I think I've even characterized it like this on a previous Grizz. It seemed like Adam West and Burt Ward got a bunch of their friends together, made Halloween costumes, and filmed this as a joke one weekend and put out Legends of the Superheroes. Of course, there was a lot more behind it than that. But that's, to like the uninitiated, you'd probably think that's what it is. It's like a bad home movie. And it is as good quality as it possibly can be. And it comes with like three worthless deleted scenes. Like, I just wanted any kind of anything that expanded on what were they thinking when they made this? And the one deleted scene, it's actually it's kind of enjoyable. Like, Batman and Solomon Grundy are about to fight at a gas station. And this is such a low budget production that people who, you know, like, are not supposed to be there because it was on location, it wasn't on a set, just walk into the shot. Like, pedestrians just walk into the shot.
I need to watch this.
Well, I tell you what. You have two collections of mine of some prized possessions I have as it relates to Batman and Spider-Man.
Right.
And if you'll return these to me, I will loan you Legends of the Superheroes.
All right.
Because it's perfect. Like, what our sons' ages are right now, to right. them, it's amazing. And that's the age I was when I saw it. The problem is, to us now, you watch, you're like, oh my God, please stop.
Well, that's why I really want the 60s Batman on DVD. I hope they release that. Mm. You know, I mean, all those classic shows have gone over to Netflix now. So you've got, you know, Star Wars or Star Trek, you've got those other shows that are all available. You can watch all of the, you know, I mean, heck, you can watch like all of the Star Trek The Next Generation episodes, whatever it is, all 9, 10 seasons of that. Mm-hmm. There are even more maybe available you can watch, like every Voyager episode, anything you want to watch. But like Batman, you can't find it. It's gone. Nowhere to see it, you know?
Yep.
So I hope they release that puppy.
Me too. Now, this week, Clayton and I had really meant to spend a lot of time talking about music, and we really didn't. And here's why. Because we've acquired a number of things, one of which is the first album by the Blue Nile from 1984. So there's a very good chance that Clayton will have listened to that by the time we reconvene to make another Grizz. And Clayton also came across this list of 10 albums. And why don't you set this up?
Right. Wired Magazine put together, and I think this is interesting, that it's not just like the 10 albums you'd expect from your year in review, the best albums on the top of iTunes, you know, like the crappy, like, sort of Call Me Maybe or whatever else you know, you're used to hearing out there, the pop songs. But instead, they put together a list. Forget the hit singles that you heard this year. Here are the best albums of 2012. I'm trying to pull it up here, but where is it? But some pretty interesting choices on here. Norah Jones, her new album.
Right, Little Broken Hearts is on there. The much ballyhooed Channel Orange by Frank Ocean is on there. What else? The Yaysayer, just Yaysayer is what they're called. The XX is on there. How to Dress Well. And the idea behind it was
Cat
that these
Power.
Are...
Cat Power.
Yes, Cat Power is one of them. But the idea is that these are albums you need to listen to as an album. That you can't just cherry pick out one song and listen to it. That as an album, it tells a greater story.
Right, right. That's a good way to sum it up as I was trying to find this, find the list here. In any event, they are pretty interesting. And there, you know, there's some rap albums on there, which I'm not a big fan of. And so I sort of excluded that from our discussions when you and I were on the phone. But I think you and I both managed to pick up almost all of those albums that are available, the ones that were listed in Wired Magazine's Best Albums of 2012, the ones mm-hmm. that you mentioned, the Yaysayer, Norah Jones' new album, Frank Ocean, the XX, Cat Power, and I think there's maybe one or two other ones in there
right.
As well. the only one I initially owned, I think, was the Norah Jones album.
Right.
I didn't own any of the other ones, so it was interesting. Anyway, some of the stuff I'm really into, and I have to say, I mean, maybe we can have everyone grab the albums, or maybe you already have some of them. We can talk about it next week on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we can sort of run down our thoughts on the sort of the best albums of 2012. And I thought it might be fun if you and I forget like Wired Magazine, right? I mean, they have a good list there. We can chat about that next week, or we can chat about it now. Maybe we do a best of Grizz our picks for best albums of 2012 next week. Maybe we each pick three. We each pick three albums, perhaps, and hopefully we won't have a lot of spillover. And then we maybe we can play a track or two from each next week on the show. So we'll have a little homework. We'll come prepared for maybe our three favorite albums of 2012 for a total of six albums.
Okay. I think that's possible. Promises. So we'll work on that. And in the meanwhile, of course, you know where we hang out, right? Clayton's over on Fox and Friends like all the time right now.
Yeah. Nonstop through the holiday.
That's right. Follow him at Clayton Morris. I'm at Mike Quackenbush. You can catch me here over on The Dob. I'm also on The Trending Show here and there. Just here and there, though.
Yeah. Just depends on your schedule. Really. So catch us. Hey, we'll see you next time. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at Grizzly Bear Cafe. If you have any questions, concerns, thoughts, feedback, we would love to hear it. You can send it our way, and we will try to read some of it in the show. Have a great new year if we don't talk to you before that. I guess, will we talk to him before that?
I don't know.
Probably not.
I don't know.
Anyway, we'll figure it out. We'll figure this calendar thing out.
Get my assistant on it. Bye now.
See you next year.